This episode of the Missions Podcast is sponsored by Reformation Heritage Books, publisher of How to Lead Your Family by Dr. Joel Beakey, a concise, practical guide to biblical leadership in the home. Use the code LEADABWE, all caps, at rhb.org to get 20% off now through September 30th. Greetings and welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, Director of Communications and Engagement with ABWE, joined for another encouraging spelunking expedition into the mine shafts of missiology with Scott W. Dunford, pastor of Redeemer. Pastor of Western Hills Church in San Mateo, California. If you know, you know. Scott, thanks for wading through this incredibly awkward introduction for us.
Yeah, and thanks. No, you're good at that.
It's fine. You can mention some of my past jobs too. And speaking of past jobs, we're talking to someone who's also changed employment in recent years, but we won't make a big deal about that. Before we get into that, though, you can get more content at missionspodcast.com. You can also get access to our bonus show that we'll record right after this main episode at missionspodcast.com/premium. Scott, we've talked about different themes along these lines on the show before. We've talked about when helping hurts. We've talked about this idea of toxic charity. I think so often in the Christian world, especially in the realm of missions, we can desire to do good. We can have pure motives, and yet that can be that can lead to mistakes that we make. That can also allow other people to take advantage of us as well. And I know somebody who in recent years has written extensively on this topic is our guest today.
Yes. So we're excited to welcome to the show Dr. Joe Rigney. He serves as fellow of theology at New St. Andrews College, pastors at Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho. He has a PhD from the University of Chester and is the author of several books. Probably the one that I know the best is Live Like a Narnian, which we recommend to you. More recently, written some
good
books.
Life advice. Always live like a Narnian. Amen.
Yes. Yes. And leadership and emotional sabotage. And before going to New St. Andrews, he was served as the president of Bethlehem College and Seminary, which is what Alex was joking about. Teaching on a lot of subjects, especially related to C.S. Lewis, Shakespeare, political philosophy, and beyond. We're glad to have you on, Joe. Sorry for we are usually way more professional than that, but hey, just barely holding it together at this
point.
Not
way more, just a little more.
Yeah. I'm just gonna say I doubt it. No, thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be on here.
So, what would you say? Okay, let's zoom out. Let's think about one book that recently I read, our pastor read. I don't know if any of our other, I think one of our other elders read it. Leadership and emotional sabotage. What would you say is responsible, let's put it positively, for when there's success in a Christian ministry or any Christian organization, be it a church, be it a mission agency? What's responsible when there's success, but then also what sorts of things in your experience, in your writing, would you say tends to lead to the downfall of a ministry?
Yeah, well, in terms of the sabotage question, frequently, especially in agitated times, times of turbulence, times of angst and so forth, which we live in, it's very difficult to maintain mission clarity and mission will, like to know this is what we're doing and we're going to do it well. And if you do that in a context of agitation, frequently you'll find that there are those who want to derail you, who want to take you off that mission. So when I talk about sabotage, I mean any effort to take you off of the mission that your institution, which could be your family, it could be your church, could be a missions agency, could be a school, whatever that thing is for by God's design, in anxious and agitated times, there will be people who will try to take it off that mission and make it focus on something other than what it's for. And that will take a variety of forms, everything from name calling and so forth, to appeals to compassion. Don't you care about this thing also? And if you don't, if you say, no, we're focused here, we can't do that, then expect to be, that's where the name calling would come in. That's where efforts to steer you, to try to get you to elevate some other agenda over your own. And I think one of the features, I learned this from a Jewish rabbi, wrote a book called A Failure of Nerve back in the 2000s. But he talks about in these contexts, the tendency in reactive institutions is to adapt to the most reactive and immature members of that institution, to allow them to set the agenda, to establish direction, rather than the most mature leaders. The most mature leaders are often kneecapped and sabotaged by the rest of the community for being, say, insufficiently empathetic, for being heartless and uncaring, because you're trying to maintain the purpose for which that institution exists. So that's kind of like the big picture of what that book is trying to do, is how do you become the kind of sober-minded, courageous, bold, and compassionate leader that institutions need, as opposed to having your institution sabotaged and steered by the reactive and immature.
Scott, you've been in critical leadership positions in multiple Christian organizations, including my own. If you're new to the show, guys, like, Scott recruited me to ABWE. So if you ever like, who's this guy with a podcast? Actually blame Scott. Truly. but in the Christian world, you know, what Joe's talking about here is a real thing, because mission drift is such a temptation, because everything looks good, right? There's so much to do as Christians. There's so many good works for us to be about. It can be really hard to say no. And when we're sort of led by that impulse, that's just a real temptation that many of us feel, right, Scott?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I know I've felt that many times, and especially it's over something maybe good, or they use a pejorative against you that, hey, you're not courageous if you don't speak on my issue. Well, maybe I'm courageous because I'm not speaking on your issue. I don't know. Maybe that's another way of looking at it. But talking, you've written a lot about this book, a lot about the topic of empathy. I don't think there's been any controversy about that at all, right?
No, everybody just totally accepted it. It was like, everybody's like, yeah, of course, this is the sin of empathy. Yeah. That makes total sense.
Yeah. And I kind of understand, you know, like, empathy is a newer word but a concept that I think we all understand, of like putting yourself in someone else's shoes, right? Coming into their perspective. And you kind of maybe hit it for the nose when you say, hey, there's the sin of empathy. And I know you're doing it a little bit to kind of get a reaction. But help us understand where you're coming from on that. Help us understand the distinction you're making between what we'd call biblical compassion and empathy, and empathy in a worldly sense. And I just want to, I'm going to add one more question to it, just from my own perspective of like, maybe we disagree on what the world is like, but I mean, the issues we're facing right now, I think we agree on what the world is like. I see more of a problem with young Christian men that don't have compassion, that don't put themselves in other people's shoes. Then I see a problem with too much compassion or untethered empathy, as you talk about it. So maybe kind of help us walk us through why this topic, why now, and why you think this is so important.
Yeah, let's start with that last part first. Like, why? I suspect that the difference there is simply, personal experience, where we've been, the kind of circles or communities we've been a part of. Different communities have different temptations. In the context that I've been in over the years, which is typically, it's been a reformed evangelical context, especially over the last 10 to 15, the idea of someone's empathy, compassion, sympathy, whatever word you use for it, being used as a tool of manipulation in order to do that steering and sabotage that I mentioned earlier, was pretty common. Like I saw it repeatedly utilized that way. And so when I talk about the sin of empathy, I'm not talking about all feelings of affection or all desire to alleviate the suffering of others, right? Like that, like part of the principle that I'm working with is that every good thing can be corrupted. Every human good can be corrupted. One of the things I learned from C.S. Lewis most especially was it's the best things that become the greatest evils. The devil was an archangel. That's why he's the devil. And so when Lewis writes the Four Loves and talks about that, your love for your family, like maternal love, is a great and glorious thing. But if God's hand's not on the reins, it becomes possessive and tyrannical, devouring. And it still calls itself mother love. That's still the name on the box, is this is mother love. But now it's become a really ugly form of hatred that's manipulative and possessive.
Like and the mother and her son in The Great Divorce, exactly that she's right. just obsessed with him. Yeah,
exactly right. And so what I've done is say, hey, that principle, which you could take from mother love or father love, you could do it with friendship, you could do it with romantic love. That principle is relevant in more places. And one of the ones in the modern world that I think it's particularly relevant is the love for the weak and the hurting and the broken, where when God's hand's not on the reins, when our compassion, our empathy becomes untethered from what's true, from what's good, from what's wise, it does become highly destructive. And so mentioning earlier, when helping hurts or the toxic charity principle, I'm operating in that same space and trying to say there is a form of empathy. And I think empathy is the modern word for it. I think that's been deliberate. I think there's ways in which people have sort of, there's a long Christian tradition of reflection on pity and sympathy. Those are the older words. That's what's going to be in your King James Bible. That's what Christian theologians were writing about 100 years ago. This modern word was presented to us as a kind of upgraded version of those things. It's an new and improved empathy, or empathy is compassion 2.0. But the improvement usually had something to do with validate all the feelings of those who are hurting, affirm them, stay out of judgment, no judgment here. And it was presented as this is actually a more loving and compassionate response to those who are hurting to check any judgment, to have this kind of relativistic impulse kind of woven in.
Can I interrupt you real quick too? You're not making that up. I mean, like when you listen to Brené Brown, for instance, present the idea of empathy, that's exactly what she's saying, is you have to crawl completely into someone's experience and not really critique their behavior, their actions really at all, right? That's kind of what you hear from some of the secular self-help sources on this.
Yeah, and she has more careful moments where she recognizes the importance of boundaries, but she definitely can give that impression. And I think that this is a human feature and a universal one of anybody who's ever been on the receiving end of a pity party or a guilt trip, right? Like knows what I'm talking about. It's where someone recognizes, I know you care for me and I can wield that as a weapon and a tool of emotional blackmail in order to get you to do what I want. And so it's an old feature. It's a universal human feature. I just think in the modern world, then it has a name, and that name is empathy. Now that doesn't mean that there aren't perfectly legitimate uses of it. I tend to not, the word is not the most important thing to me. In the book, I try to critique it under a number of different titles. Pity, passion of pity is the term C.S. Lewis used for it. Mm. But in the modern world, I think that's where it hides. And I think this is one of the devil's strategies. He hides really destructive dynamics under innocuous and innocent terms. And because most people can't imagine empathy ever being bad, if I'm the devil, that's where I'm going to put it. And so when I say, if I were to write a book about the sin of anger, I think most people would go, yeah, okay, there's good and bad anger. There's a righteous anger and there's an unrighteous anger. Or if we talked about grief or if we talked about fear, I think most people have categories for there was a worldly version of this emotion and there's a righteous version of this emotion. And we would go, and the difference is, well, are we feeling according to biblical standards? Are we feeling what God says we should feel about this? And is it oriented toward the ultimate good of that person or towards the ultimate good of the community? And if it is, we'd say that's the good version. If it's not, then it's not. And I think it's one of the challenges in the modern world is we just don't have a category for empathy or compassion ever going wrong. They're sort of unadulterated goods. And I don't think they are. I think that there are toxic, destructive, sinful, untethered forms of empathy. And I think over the last 10 or 15 years, especially, it's been used effectively to derail Christian institutions by taking them away from biblical standards.
Well, one thing that I think is relevant to, you mentioned the beginning of your response to Scott, Joe, you know, that there's difference of opinion. Okay, what kind of world do we live in? Do we have people that aren't compassionate enough or people that are too compassionate to this point of sinful empathy? And I think you're right. It reflects what circles you've run in. It's sort of like when people ask me the question of, you know, do we have too many people interested in missions to the expense of their locality or not enough people interested in missions? And honestly, it's like, depends where you look.
Right.
That's my best answer to that. And so I think there's a lot that we can chew on there. Scott, I know you want to press in on that some more. And so, Scott, I'll let you press in on that in a moment. Before, I want to mention our sponsor, Reformation Heritage Books. If you are a Christian man like me, and if you, like me, want to become a better husband and a better father, and I think we all do, then in How to Lead Your Family, speaking of great books, Dr. Joel Beakey offers a biblical and practical guide for leading the home as a prophet and a priest and a king, that threefold office that we all have as men that we get from Adam and ultimately from Christ. Drawing from decades of pastoral and family life experience, this short read is packed with wisdom and encouragement to help men lead with conviction and grace and emotional anti-fragility and all the sorts of things that our guest here is talking about today. And so you can visit rhb.org to get your copy and to learn more. And you can use the code LEADABWE, all caps, to get 20% off your order. Also, if you're a first-time customer, then when you order, you'll get an email back with a coupon for 10% off your next order as well. But hurry, this offer ends September 30th.
I think the thing that when I say the world I'm living in, I guess I'm referring to like our reformed world, especially, and I realize X doesn't cover everyone, you know, out there, right? There's a lot of guys who just by God's grace aren't on social media. You know, like one of our good friends, Chris Bruno, just isn't on it at all. And I appreciate that about him.
That's one of the many things that makes him a good man.
What I do worry about is a real callousness towards the needs of others that I see amongst our guys who are in seminary and in pastoral ministry. Inability to see anything, any need other than their own circle of influence, their own church, their own family, their own friends. And of course, for the missions, in missions related, you know, relatedly to missions, this becomes a big problem as well. Obviously, I know it can go overboard, but are you concerned at all about a callousness toward other people's needs that we need to be worried about as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, so in the book itself, I try to hit the apathy and the callousness at the front end and then come back around at the end and conclude the book. You know, if you're going to write a book on the sin of empathy, I don't want the abuse of it to abolish the proper use of it. Yeah. And, you know, so compassion is still a virtue, even though it can be untethered and corrupted. And so that final chapter in praise of compassion and trying to model, like, what does it look like when you're with someone who's hurting? How does Jesus at the tomb of Lazarus? I use an example from Brothers Karamazov, which is a novel that I taught for years, that kind of shows, here's this person who's really suffering and maybe doing things that are wrong even, right? So in their suffering, they're sinning. How do you actually have compassion for the suffering while still addressing the sinfulness? I think that that's a really important skill pastorally. And so I want to include that. But it was more like, I think in the book, I use this illustration where if someone's drowning in quicksand, one response would be to, you know, walk the other way, turn around, don't even care, that kind of callous indifference that you mentioned. The other response would be jump in with both feet. And that's what I mean by untethered empathy, because now you've got you're untethered from the side and now you're drowning with them. And then the proper response is you reach in there. So you really do join them. You weep with those who weep. You join them in the sorrow, but you remain anchored and tethered to the side so that you can actually have some leverage to pull them out. And I think of those three, most people, at least in principle, recognize that first danger of callous indifference. Like if I were to write a book about the sin of apathy or the sin of indifference, I think all I would get is amens. And in fact, one of the interesting dynamics in this, when I first was writing on it, I wrote two Screwtape letters in the style of Screwtape letters that you're included in the book. And I wrote the first one to kind of get at that, you know, all that matters is that we speak the truth. It doesn't matter how that kind of, you know, ham-fisted compassion that always is correcting people when they're hurting, and did it in that Screwtape mode where like the devil is encouraging this. And it was like, all I got from that one, it was largely crickets. People read it. And I think everybody went, yeah, that's a problem. But it was only when I said, well, there's another ditch, and it's the ditch of the sin of empathy, that all of a sudden everybody lit their hair on fire. And what that tells me is one danger, even if it's still there, even if it's a real thing, is at least one that's commonly recognized and that you could point at and say, if you were to call it out or if you were to address it in a sermon, if you have the world's goods and you don't do anything to help your neighbor, it doesn't matter what you say. You've closed your heart to them and the love of God is not in you. Like we recognize that one. I think it's harder for people, especially Christians who have been told rightly, be compassionate, be kind, and be tenderhearted, that this does need to be anchored to what's true and good. And so it was the danger that nobody saw coming. It's the thing that nobody could recognize. And that's where I decided to lean in. And that's what provoked the reaction. And in many cases, I think provoked some thought. I just was talking to a guy yesterday who came and said, you know, when you first did that, I just thought, this is crazy. I didn't finish the interview the first time I saw it because I was so, and then after a little bit, I went back and said, well, I better finish it. And the more I thought about it, the more I started to recognize when this manipulative form of empathy was in play. And now he was on board and trying to strike the balance of, I don't want to be apathetic. I don't want to be untetheredly empathetic. I want to be biblically compassionate. But it does take people a minute because it's so unusual.
Yeah, just switching gears, if we can, just for a second to talk about missions. So, I mean, you were at Bethlehem. I went to Bethlehem when I was in seminary. And it wasn't just John Piper, of course. I mean, although John Piper is probably one of the most well-known in our generation for his appeals to missions and the impact he's had on calling people, young people, to the mission field. Thankful for that. But there's no way around it. When people are encouraging young people to go into missions, almost always, even though I know John Piper, I think, does it wonderfully about pointing to the glories of God and calling people to call worshipers out from among the nations, there's no way around not pointing out the huge need. You know, William Carey did the same thing and in pointing out, hey, there's billions of people who do not know the gospel. And it really is, you listen to those messages, it really pulls on your heartstrings, right? If you're a lover of Jesus and a lover of people. And I think those of us in mobilization, you know, I was in mobilization, ABWE, Alex has led the mobilization at a different time at ABWE, and I'm sure others listening here thinking about mobilization to missions, is a real like tension about how much guilt to lay on people about the need around the world. And so how would you say this idea of compassion or empathy, how would you apply this to the calling people to missions and the needs around the world?
I have two thoughts on that. One is, tethered compassion, biblical compassion means tethered to what's true. So is it true that Christ is a great savior? And is it true that there's a great need in the world? If those are true statements, and if the gospel is the answer, and so it's good for people for the gospel, then to tie emotional appeals to those truths is an absolutely legitimate thing. So to say this is the actual state of affairs, like as Carey does, or as missions mobilizers in general do, and then to say, what are you, you know, and then to lay the call open and say, who will answer this, right? Who's going to go? I think is a legitimate thing. And for there to be an emotional dimension. I think, so that's, at one level, that's a totally legitimate thing. The danger comes, I think, when guilt becomes the primary motive, when people feel like it's, because what often happens, this is true, not just of missions, but it's also true of, you know, when you show the videos of starving kids in Africa in order to get donations to feed my starving children or something like that. When people are motivated fundamentally by guilt, they will only give enough to make the guilt go away.
Right.
The goal, and which is usually about $20. And so you give just enough in order to salve the guilt feelings that you have, as opposed to the motive being fundamentally something like, God has been so generous with me, and I want to share the grace that I've been given, I want to extend to others. You freely received, therefore freely give. And so it's the freeness of grace, it's gratitude to God. It's the prospect of more grace on the horizon, you know, what Piper would always call faith in future grace, that like there's more grace there. And so pour yourself out. And there's a kind of joy and ebullience that comes from the gospel that is a far more enduring and it's a better motive. So Lewis, another thing I learned from Lewis, he said pity was meant to be a spur to joy to help misery. So pity, why did God invent pity? It's meant to be like a spur to the joyful, to those who have joy, to help those who are in misery. And you could apply that to those who have lost a loved one and those who are languishing apart from the gospel, right? There's misery and joy needs a little prompt sometimes in order to go do something about it. Mm. And pity is designed for that. Like that's what pity, properly speaking, is. And it leads to that compassionate action. But then Lewis's point is it can be used the wrong way around as a kind of emotional blackmail where you hold joy up for ransom and you say, I'm going to shoot joy if you don't do what I want. And I think there's a way, you know, there are missions appeals that can lapse into that where you lay it on thick in order to say, in order to motivate people by the guilt and so forth, in order to get them to go. And they'll go in, so as long as that guilt feeling is fresh in their mind, they'll do what you want. But as soon as you're out of the picture, all of a sudden they'll lapse back into something because it was pure emotion and pure manipulation at the top. Instead, it's laid before them. This is what God has promised. This is what God has given you. This is the need that's out there. And what great thing do you want to do? So I love the carry appeal of expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. Mm-hmm. Like that is I delivered at our missions conference last year. We were doing biographies. I drew Carey, and it was like that hope of God has great things in store. Don't you want to be a part of it? Like expect them and then attempt them. Go do it. I think is a far more enduring appeal than simply trying to guilt people into the missions endeavor. Mm.
And more biblical too. I see Paul talking that way more. I don't see Paul talk so much about like, oh, just think about the lost pagan Roman person who's never heard the gospel. Think about them consigned to hell for eternity. Again, not that you shouldn't think about that if you're in Paul's shoes, but I hear him talking more about the manifest glory of God revealed in the church and so forth. So all of this is kind of geared around, okay, how do we ensure success, not worldly success, but buoyancy, endurance in our ministries, in our missionary efforts, in our churches. So in a minute or two, because we're short on time, how do we build that anti-fragility where we're not easily manipulated, where we can't be turned one way or another by some of these overly guilt-riddled appeals?
Yeah. So in leadership and emotional sabotage, the fundamental virtue that I'm trying to commend is sober-mindedness, which shows up in all of the pastoral lists. It's one of the ones usually at the front, you know, one woman, man, and then you're going to get above reproach and sober-mindedness right there at the beginning. And it's one of those Bible words that you kind of gloss over, quite frankly, I did for years thinking like, oh yeah, check that box. What does it mean? And I think it means someone who has a clarity of mind and a stability of soul and a readiness to act. Meaning there's a clarity of like, what is life about? There's mission clarity. There's theological clarity. And that clarity means I'm not clouded by my passions, you know, or other people's passions are not, you know, overwhelmingly. That's how we talk. Passions can be so, you know, I'm overwhelmed by grief and paralyzed by fear, and passions can overwhelm us so we don't think clearly. Well, sober-minded people see clearly. They know what's what. And then they have a stability of soul. They fear the Lord. They love God. And so there's a ballast in their boat when things get hard, when things are tossed. They can weather those storms because there's some stability. And then they're not passive or apathetic. They're not checked out, but they're ready to act. They're like, they're girding up the loins of their mind and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought. So there's this notion of like, I'm ready to lean into what God's called me because I can see clearly and I'm not running around like a chicken with my head cut off. And I think that's a fundamental virtue for all Christian leaders to cultivate, is that kind of sober-mindedness.
We don't use terms like that anymore. It's so helpful. Joe, how can people get a hold of you and get more of what you've written?
On X, Joe_Rigney. It's the only social media I do. And then canonpress.com is a great resource. You can use my name, Joe99, to get like a 99 cent for the first month. You can listen to both my books or a bunch of my books that way for 99 cents and then decide if you like Canon Plus. So canonplus.com.
99 Cent Joe, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us on the Missions Podcast. And perhaps you aren't riddled with guilt, but you do genuinely want to be a part of what God's doing in the world. Well, you can do that and figure out how at abwe.org. Take your next steps in the Great Commission. Get more content from us at missionspodcast.com and leave us a note while you're there. Don't forget to also leave us a positive rating and review in your podcast platform of choice. And join us for the premium subscriber section coming after this main recording is over, where Scott and I are going to react to this and talk about a test that you can administer to your fellow teammates, even to an elder candidate, to someone in your life that's stepping into Christian ministry or leadership in some way. What's the test that you can administer? We'll talk about that and we'll react to this conversation and more in the bonus episode. So join to get access to that until our next exciting conversation on missions, theology, and practice. Go make disciples of all the nations.